Okay, our title slide for this evening is taken from a location immediately adjacent to the ancient tell of Jericho. And if you look closely here, I think you can see that there's a tower right here, and then some cables you can't really see, I'm sure. But you can probably make out that there's this multi-level, three- or four-story structure on the side of this mountain here. Both this structure and this structure, I believe, are old monasteries from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. This is a more modern hotel restaurant thing. And then there's a cable car that runs up to that so that you can get a look over Jericho itself and then all the plains of Moab, Naphta, Mount Nebo, and all. I've never actually taken that cable car, but I was looking at it today. You know, I'm going to be going a little while, and I was thinking maybe Mark and I, Carl, would get up there. And they're advertising it as the longest cable car in the world that's below sea level. Now, there's only one other contender, and that's Masada, which actually is a much more impressive cable car ride because it's a lot steeper. You get a lot higher. Effectively, I'm sure it would take you at least to the top of that particular mountain, which probably most erroneously is referred to here as the Mount of Temptation. All the local legend is that that's where Jesus, you know, spent his 40 days and nights in the wilderness being tempted by the devil. But be that as it may, which is completely unverifiable at least, it also helps you to see that surprisingly, in going back into ancient times, and certainly back to first century times, the land is actually fairly fertile. The only problem is trying to get, you know, the water there. And there's been a variety of ways that they've worked with the water. And you'll also notice, that, well, there's not so many in this particular picture, that there's a lot of palms. And again, back in antiquity, Jericho was known as the city of palms. And so I understand it was really quite beautiful. Now, Herod's maybe favorite palace is also located here, although the ruins have not been excavated very extensively. So, but you know, he had a palace in here, being all the money in the world at the time, and wanted to live in Jericho. So while it is far below sea level, can be 120 and more in a high summer, really is a pretty great place to live. And so here on the plains of Moab, though this is this far away from where the Israelites were before the invasion, you see at least a little bit of what those plains of Moab would be like. Now, I told everybody before we had our prayer and started the tape that I thought I would spend just one moment in Jeremiah chapter 3. Now, I'm going to do that only because in the class schedule for our Wednesday night class, I do have extra time. And so last week I decided, well, you know, I've got actually two class periods probably that I could spare. And so effectively we just threw it open last week to further discussion on Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4, which of course is kind of the heart of all the controversies on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. I didn't prepare 1 minute for more on that topic tonight, but I want to make this one comment from Jeremiah 3, and then if you want to spend some more time on that, you know, well, hit me. Well, I'd be happy to spend some time on it, but if not, I think we'll go ahead on in to the rest of that chapter. What I want to point out, though, is that we have a sort of a corollary to those first four verses in Deuteronomy 24 here. In Jeremiah chapter 3, if you'll start in verse 6, "Then Yahweh said to me in the days of Josiah the king, have you seen what faithless Israel did? She went up on every high hill and under every green tree, and she was a harlot there." This is their word for porneia when it gets translated into the Greek, you know, for the sake of Septuagint. "And I thought, after she has done all these things," in verse 7, "she will return to me, but she did not return. And her treacherous sister Judah saw it. And I saw that for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I had sent her away and given her a writ of divorce." So here in Jeremiah, you have a reference to Deuteronomy 24's writ of divorce that we talked about last week and have been extensively in our Sunday morning class studies. So there it is in practice as God views it. And again, the divorce is only because of fornication. This is the only divorce that has been authorized by God in the Old Testament for fornication. None other was ever permitted. No lesser misbehavior was grounds for divorce. But here it is, the adulteries, the harlotries, the fornication, and the writ of divorce. Verse 9, it came about because... I don't think I finished 8. And I sought it for all the adulteries of faithless Israel. I had sent her away, given her a writ of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but she went and was a harlot also. Came about because of the lightness of her harlotry that she polluted the land and committed adultery with stones and trees. And in spite of all this, her treacherous sister Judah did not return to me with all her heart, but rather in deception, declares the Lord. And Yahweh said to me, faithless Israel has proved herself more righteous than treacherous Judah. So, the one even sees it going on and doesn't do any better, makes her even worse. And so I thought, as we now head back to Deuteronomy 24, if you wanted to write in the margin of Deuteronomy 24, Jeremiah 3, verses 6 through 11, Jeremiah 3, 6 through 11, next to verse 1, where you have that certificate of divorce, then you'd have your little concordance reference there to that writing of divorce being employed by God because and only because of adultery. Okay, with that said, does anybody want to root around those first four verses anymore? I certainly don't particularly, but if you got a question or some comment, by all means, let's go ahead and do that. But I feel like we pretty well thrashed over all that material. Did anybody? Okay, well then let's run in to that remainder of 24, the bulk of 24, and maybe even get on into chapter 25. I've allotted 2 chapters a night, and we've still got a good schedule there, no problem. So if you're following the outlining, once again, I'm doing the same thing tonight. I've done a couple of nights now. I'm just going to leave this slide up, but there are so many different and sundry laws that I'm going to go ahead and just tell you what the verse references are, and then if you want to make your own little marks there, as I do, drawing a horizontal line across to the margin at the breaks in each of these verse sections, then I'll give you a title for each one. So the first 4 verses in Deuteronomy 24 I just called divorce. Then you have a single law in verse 5. When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be free at home 1 year and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. If you like, you can reference there Deuteronomy 20 verse 7, which we've already covered, of course, and which has a similar idea. 27 says, who is the man that is engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. Now, it's not a repeat of the same law, but that was in the section of chapter 20, verses 1 through 9, that are all about preparing for battle. So in those 9 verses, we are told who's exempt. And in those 9 verses, he's mentioned the same thing, or a very similar thing that you have right here. If you're betrothed or recently married, either way, then you're free from the threat of death in a military confrontation. And if you've just married, you're free from all military duty for an entire year. Okay, verse 6 also is a single law. In verse 6, no one shall take a handmill or an upper millstone in pledge, for he would be taking a life in pledge. So that single verse I labeled pledge. You understand that, and in fact, it's just an awful lot of fun if you have access to the internet and you really dig quite a bit. You could find a number of libraries in various archives, like the Smithsonian and that sort of thing. I've spent endless hours doing this, and so there's quite a number of different sites. But if you dig hard, you can find these various sites, and they will have treasure troves of thousands of photographs going back, many of them into the 1800s and throughout the 1900s, that will show you what life was like in the Middle East in those days.
and would therefore be very like the life that they were living for the preceding 1800 or 1900 years to the time of Christ, and another 1,000 years or more back into the Old Testament. These cultures and societies were agriculturally based, though, of course, there was a lot of sales going on, merchandising going on. But, you know, essentially people had their lands and they plowed their lands and they took care of the fruit of their lands and they lived on those lands, did very little travel. But they did not have, you know, Gen Air appliances. They were not running down to the Sears store, you know, to buy ovens. And so that way of life required a lot of work with stones that had been particularly shaped so that they could ground their wheat into flour and those kinds of things, whether you were going to be a local mill or just as a single homeowner. And in those cases, you take away those stones, and it's the end of all things for those people. If you deprive them of the means to make a meal or a living, if they are selling their flour to other people, well, that's just really serious. And so never permit it. You may owe you a lot of money, but, you know, you don't tell the guy you're going to cut off the gas to his house in our day, and now he can't cook anymore. That's the pledge in verse 6. So you take a handmill or an upper stone and pledge. You're taking a life and pledge. It's just forbidden. You don't do it. Number 7 is kidnapping again. If a man is caught kidnapping any of his countrymen of the sons of Israel, and he pleads with him, deals with him violently or sells him, then that thief, he's a kidnapper, but he's a thief, thief of people, shall die. So you shall purge the evil from among you. This was also discussed back in Leviticus 13, so we spent a whole lot of time on this. It's one of quite a large number of capital offenses, therefore carrying a death penalty, that you'll find in Leviticus and elsewhere. Probably no comment on that. If there is, you know, stop me anytime you like, but pretty straightforward. Wish it were still true to this day. In 8 and 9, you have more of what's an awful lot of law with regard to a wide variety of things that are referred to as leprosy. So, write leprosy for verses 8 and 9, and then effectively you can just put Leviticus 13. It's got 59 verses, and they're all of them dealing with these various forms of leprosy. Some are referred to as boils, all kinds of laws in 59 verses dealing with it. So, again, we're not going to spend much time on it tonight or any unless you got a comment or question. You know, covered all that here a few months back in Leviticus chapter 13. Anybody? Okay, then verses 10 through 13 is pledges again. And so we often think, you know, kind of odd that we wouldn't have it, you know, adjoining verse 6. You know, and be arranged differently. Now, I don't know how these things came to be arranged the way they are. I don't know why God would move Moses to reveal it in this order. I'm not seeing a connection of any kind, so I just can't explain it. Today, we would group that material differently. Doesn't make it wrong, just makes it different. But we're back to pledges again in verses 10 through 13. When you make your neighbor a loan of any sort, you shall not enter his house to take his pledge. You shall remain outside, and the man to whom you make the loan shall bring the pledge out to you. And if he is a poor man, you shall not sleep with his pledge. When the sun goes down, you shall surely return the pledge to him, that he may sleep in his cloak and bless you. And it will be righteousness for you before the Lord your God. Now, in this case, I'm not only going to have you write in the margin Exodus 22, verses 26 and 27. Exodus 22, 26 and 27. But let me go back while you're jotting that down and I'll read those for you. Exodus 22, 26. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets. For that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Okay?
Your microphone sounds like the battery's low.
No, it's not.
It's not? Keep stepping up?
No.
It's interference from people using Wi-Fi in the church.
I'm sorry, it's interference from what?
People using devices in the church. It's interfering with the communication.
Okay, if you didn't know that, it does create a problem for you to have your phone on. I bring mine, but I always shut it down. I don't have it on, but all the way off. And then their signals are always being generated. In the world we live in now, we're always swimming through a sea of electronic transmissions. But if you can just switch those off, it'd be helpful. What happened here? There we go. Okay, so make that reference at verses 8 and 9. At verses 10 through 13 with regard to pledges. Exodus 22, verses 26 and 27 says the same thing. It also reveals, I suspect, just a little bit of an insight, I guess, into the culture and how things worked. Now, obviously, if you're taking a pledge, then why do you do it and what's going on? Somebody owes you money. So if they owe you money, then they've got some kind of financial distress. Nobody borrows money just for fun, I guess, you might be some big wheeler dealer developer or something, but these are people that are impoverished is what it's about. And if they're impoverished, think of the depth of the impoverishment. If you don't even have a blanket left, it's the only thing you can sleep in. So what Exodus says, what's he going to sleep in? He doesn't have anything else. So how cruel would it be to say, well, you owe me money, I'm going to take this pledge. It's, the collateral. If you default, I get to keep it. But the poor person is down to the point where they don't even have a blanket to warm themselves at night. Then you take that back over to their house and you let them sleep in it. You're not going to torment them at such a ridiculous level for such a debt might be. But we haven't addressed, the first part here, which is verse 10 and 11. You shall not enter his house. You remain outside. He brings it out to you. Now, we don't have a commentary. We don't have an explanation here in Scripture, but I think it's pretty obvious. What do you suppose is the reason behind that?
That he not be embarrassed by the fact that he doesn't have possessions in his house.
I'm just really sure that's the case, and every commentator, sees the same thing. He may not be able to pay you what he owes you, and it might be a home loan. But does that mean that you get to treat that house like it's your own? You can just walk in and push this person around like this. You cannot do that. And so you still have to, knock, you still have to ask, you still have to treat them with respect. It's still their home. That is the only thing anybody's been able to come up with, and I'm sure it just has to be the case. You respect your brethren. You respect them, whether they're impoverished or not. They're human beings made in the image of God. The circumstances that they've fallen into are seldom willing. And when you find yourself in those circumstances, they often reverse themselves. And maybe the guy that's on top is going to wind up in this shape, sooner or later. There is a time for everything. And as these cycles go around, most people experience thin and thick, in the course of their lives. And so we're just going to all respect each other, these Jews in this culture and society, even if somebody is in such dire straits, you're still, recognizing as their house and not yours, even if they're not making the payments on it, you're going to take those pledges outside the house. Okay, verses 14 and 15 is your next law. I entitled it Poor Servants in my note, Poor Servants. So Leviticus 19:13 says essentially the same thing. If you want to make that note, Leviticus 19:13 is going to say the same thing. I'm not going to turn back there. But I really think you ought to add, next to verses 14, two passages from James. In the book of James, chapter 2, verses 14 through 17, you have similar thoughts, and we'll go over and read those in just a minute. And then also in James 5, verse 4, you have essentially this exact same thought. In the next verses, skipping 16, but in the next verses 17 through 22, we'll have occasion to think about James 1:27 as well. So we've got an interesting little segment right here where you can find, if not the identical statement, you find something so very similar, and then even a reference to the fact that here's James telling Christians that the law says this also. And so these principles are universal. They're found in the Old Testament. They're found in the New as well. The first of these that we'll have a look at now, verses 14 and 15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he's one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land, in your towns. Never lose sight of the fact that there was a fair number of Gentiles that lived among those Jews. And they had to treat them with the same laws and the same respect as the Jews in their promised land. So, whether he's one of your countrymen or an alien who's in your land, in your towns. 15, you shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he may not cry against you to Yahweh and it becomes sin in you. A little while ago we had God saying, you know, I'll hear it. God's listening to these prayers, and you're hurting yourself if you start acting like some overbearing, you know, lord type thinks you can oppress these people. It's just absolutely not so. So I'm going to skip the Leviticus 19 reference. I hope you've written it down. But let's go back to James for a second and just see, you know, how often it is, certainly in this passage at least, that we have the very same teachings in the New as we do in the Old. So back at James first, let's look at chapter 2, verses 14 through 17. If I get the pages to turn here. There we go. James 2, 14 through 17. What use is it, my brethren, if a man says he has faith, but he has no works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to him, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and yet you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? Even so, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. Now, brethren, all the 7 years I've been here, I know I've made this point just an awful lot. If, as I used to do, you think in terms of an Old Testament that is devoid of all faith, and it's just works, 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 that's all that counts, that's all that matters, that's all that God ever asks. And then you think of your New Testament as being faith, 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 and no works, like virtually the whole denominational world does, you know, well, and again, you've got it just absolutely wrong. From Genesis to Revelation, what God has always taught is that you are to practice a living faith. That living faith is an active faith and a working faith. To separate faith and works so completely is a dreadful mistake. You find faith all over the Old Testament. You find works all over the New, and vice versa. This is the way God has always operated. It's what God has always wanted out of His people. So this great gulf that not only the denominational world, but even to a fair extent among us, you know, gets taught so that there are just huge walls between these two. It's just not the case at all. So here's James, you know, teaching Christians what is not a quote or even an allusion, but it's still the same principle to what you have back here now in Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. But the passage that more directly says so here now, look at James 5 and verse 4. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. Well, now that's just obviously a straight reference to Deuteronomy chapter 24. When the sun goes down, you'll you shall give him his wages on his day before the sun sets, for he's poor and sets his heart on it, so that he may not cry against you to the Lord and it becomes sin in you. There's a whole lot more Old Testament in the New than I used to think. And as the years go by, I just find it more and more and more and more and more. So any comment or question on the poor servants now? You know, while you're holding, if you're in James, some of you must be, you know, hold on to James. Let's now go to 127 since we're just there. Look at 127 in James. And everybody's familiar with this. Most of us could quote it. This is pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father, to visit orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. Pure and undefiled religion. Brethren, that's the same definition God would have used under the Old Testament as well. It's the same definition He would have used for the Gentiles who were not under Moses' law since Adam and Eve. It's a true moral principle that God never suspended and said, you certain people don't have to live by this anymore. Others do. You know, He never lowered this standard. It is a pure and undefiled religion that God has always expected. And that such a religion takes care of widows and orphans in their distress and requires that you keep yourself unstained from the world. So now let's go back to Deuteronomy, where I have you write that verse in Deuteronomy chapter 24. And this verse will go next to verses 17 through 22. So, well, we're dealing with aliens, orphans, and widows. That's the title for Deuteronomy 24, verses 16 through 22. Aliens, orphans, and widows. Put James 1, 27. Because he's just saying the same thing. So here, remember though, we haven't done verse 16 yet. So after you get that written, let's back up and just look at 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their sons, nor shall sons be put to death for their fathers. Everyone shall be put to death for his own sin, not somebody else's. So that is, of course, personal death penalty. But Ezekiel's entire 18th chapter deals with this. Ezekiel 18, then, you need to write in the margin, make a reference to it. And that whole chapter is all about this very idea. And it starts off with a parable that the Jews were using at that time of Ezekiel. You know, the fathers eat the sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge is the proverb they were using. Well, it's not a biblical proverb. It's not a divine statement of wisdom. But the idea was somebody else, you know, is receiving this punishment for another's sin, and not so. So the whole 18th chapter deals with that just extensively. No one comes into this earth guilty of sin. That's just profoundly, you know, counterintuitive. Who would ever think that just on their own? It's so titanically unjust. I'm born guilty of a sin? How can that be? Well, it isn't. And so, again, the Catholic Church got it started. A huge number of Protestants believe in this, what they call original sin, Adamic sin, number of different terms that people use. But the idea is that from Adam and Eve is always passed down responsibility and guilt because they sinned. And we die because they sinned. No, we don't. Why do we die? We die because we sin. Well, but there are babies that are still born. There are infants, you know, that get killed in accidents and all the rest of that. Do they die because they're being held accountable for what Adam did? No. There's no Adamic sin. There's no original sin that they're being charged with. So the priest has to run down and mumble Latin phrases over him and sprinkle water on him that, you know, they call holy water so that the dead infant can go to heaven. That whole deal with extreme unction and all the rest of this that's tied to it, I was well familiar with it. My mom had the kit in the house. We had a cross made out of wood, quite ornate. It's about that thick. You know, I just love that thing. I guess kids everywhere would be fascinated by it. Because if you put your palm down on the top of it and you slid down, then that top part was in a track and you could pull it right out.
And then when you looked inside, there was an extreme unction kit. Had holy water and holy oil and, you know, a number of things that had been put into a slot there. So if somebody dies, you could race to a phone, call a priest, and he'd run down there, you know, and start all of his incantations. And even if, you know, you hadn't been faithful, you'd get to go to heaven. Well, that stuff is flowing out of ideas that you can't find anywhere in Scripture. But as a child, I revered that thing. It was powerful. It was sanctified. You know, it was just important. And so every once in a while, I'd go or I'd look at it, but it was always with a measure of fear and respect, you know. And my mom would tell me about how precious that was and how we would use it if somebody got killed in an accident or something, you know. It's just craziness, brethren. The whole of 18, Ezekiel is just at war with that in every conceivable way. You're responsible for your own sins. But when babies die, they haven't committed any sin. They've come into a world that what? That has been corrupted by Adam and Eve's sin, so that now I'm not dying guilty of their sin, as is these religions' doctrine, but I am coming into a world that has death and suffering in it. I get pricked by thorns for the same reason, Genesis 3 tells me. Women have a harder time in childbirth than they used to, Genesis 3 tells us. But that's not because God's holding you accountable for Adam's sin. It's because Adam's sin changed the nature of the world, and now death and suffering is present for everybody. But when the judgment comes, and all sin fall short of the glory of God, we're held accountable only for our sins, not for anybody else's. Okay, so enough on that. Let's now go to Deuteronomy 24 and have a look at this verse 17 through 22. So down to the end of the chapter, you have aliens, orphans, and widows. I've already had you write James 1:27 and our definition of pure and undefiled religion. 17, you shall not pervert the justice due an alien. Now stop. Is there justice due to the Gentiles during the old law when God had these special people? You bet there is. They deserve every piece of justice that ever there was for the Jews. You shall not pervert the justice due an alien, a Gentile then, or an orphan, or take a widow's garment in pledge. You can't even take a widow's garment. She gets to keep it. You have to bring everybody else's garment back at the end of the day so they can sleep in it. But she's made this pledge, and she gets to keep it 24/7. In 17, you shall not pervert the justice due an alien or an orphan or take a widow's garment in pledge, but you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, that Yahweh your God redeemed you from there. Therefore, I'm commanding you to do this thing. I do this because you used to be in a foreign land too. I treated you a certain way while you were in there. You're my favorite people. You suffered a lot, but I took you out. You were treated unjustly in those years. All your forefathers and mothers hated it. So don't go doing what you don't like. Brethren, how miserable does it make you feel when you're up on a freeway and suddenly you're driving the speed limit, you know, going just as fast as God will allow, and somebody roars up and gets on your tail and they're you know, 5 feet off your bumper. You know, well, okay. And so eventually you go ahead, you change lanes if you have to, then they go around you, they pull in front of you, and then they slow down, and now you're going 5 miles less than you were to start with. How's that make you feel? It's just kind of annoying, isn't it? Well, all these 7 years I've been commuting up to Washington, it takes me 5 to 6 hours each way, each time. I've seen that a lot. And I'm thinking, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you didn't like me being in front of you, you know, even though I was doing the speed limit, well, great. But if you're going to pass me, well, then what? At least do the speed limit. You know, I'm asking a lot here. You know, and so it's sensible. And everybody feels that way. You don't have to read a law to be irritated by the way people drive. It's natural. It's inherent. There are some things that just have to do with justice and fairness that you ought to be able to recognize. However, brethren, when people are oppressed,
in world history, and I think it's just without exception, when any oppressed people get now to be on top, what do they immediately become? The oppressor. I want payback. I want reparation. I want to do what was done to me and my forefathers and everybody before me. That is so wrong. And you know that it is. If you thought it was wrong when it was happening to you, why would you go do it when the circumstances are reversed? You know, it just obviously is injustice. You're not doing unto others as you experienced you wanted done to you. So again, Old Testament or New, these principles are at face value recognized by people who can do by nature the things contained in the law. So in 19, when you reap your harvest in your field and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the alien, for the Gentiles, for the orphan, and for the widow, who are not those last two denigrated because they're lumped together with an alien to make them then despised and second-class citizens or something. It's just elevating the alien, the Gentile, to the same stature as you ought to have when you see an orphan. There's a natural affinity, love, for those that don't have parents. It just particularly gets to us. When you lose a mate, you become a widow or a widower, there's a natural affection. We grieve with you and for you. Well then, remember that. In 19, when you reap your harvest, and you've forgotten a sheaf in the field, which by the way, would be really easy to do, because they clear out all these fields. But does that mean you would chop down every tree? A lot of those trees are fruit-bearing trees. Does God allow you that? Remember, you come in for war, you can't cut them down. So now, and that's not to say you can't ever cut one down, but you know, you'd leave them down because they're productive. They're giving you fruit. They're valuable. And so when you're cutting all around a wheat field, and you got a tree here, there, and everywhere, it'd be real easy for a sheaf to wind up in such a position behind, you know, the tree that you just wouldn't see it from where you were working. And then next day or two, you go walking by, you know, you're on a different fence line. Whoops, I forgot that sheaf. Now what? Tough. Why? Because you were an alien. Because it's fair. We should all be helping out for those that are left less fortunate. Gleaning was one of these core kind of values in the old Jewish law. And it ought to be in ours as well. Okay, so to read on now, let's get to 20. When you beat your olive tree, you shall not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the alien, the orphan, and the widow. So what do you get to do? As you're going along and you're banging on the branches, you know, the olives are falling down. Do you get to go back and do it again later? Try to get those last few? No. 21, when you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not go over it again. It shall be for the alien, for the orphan, for the widow. And you shall remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I'm commanding you to do this thing. So the alien, the orphan, and the widow, they are to be treated absolutely equally with all the benefit of law. If you're a Jew under the old law. Of course, we're Christians, so we don't have to do that anymore, right? Well, it's not said in the New Testament we have to do that. Well, yeah, it is in the principles that you read there. So, brethren, it particularly distresses me, and I've mentioned it several times before. We've got a major problem with immigration. Everybody knows that we do. It is a thorny issue that's been going on for a couple of hundred years, if you know anything about American history. There's never been a time when we weren't fighting over immigration. Did you know that? Never has. Okay? Now, whatever you hear, when you get to thinking that it's just real wrong for them to have rights, you know, just because they came over illegally, they shouldn't have any rights and all of that, do some meditating on these passages, because there's a whole lot of them. Now, how would you treat a widow or an orphan of ours? Think about how often God elevates that alien to the very same status and says you're going to treat them exactly the same way with all the laws. You're even going to favor them to costing you money because you can't go out and get that sheaf you left behind. You can't go beat those branches again on olives or vines. You're going to take care of them. You better remember you were a slave in Egypt. Yes, you were. Well, none of them were. None of them were. That was 40 years ago. Everybody that was an adult when you were older at that time had died. You know, they wouldn't remember it, at least if they had, you know, gotten to the age of 40 or 60 here. You know, but still, that would have been fresh in the teenagers' memories from 40 years ago. Those 50 and 55 and 59-year-olds coming in here. They might have remembered what it was like to have the lash on the back in Egyptian slavery. They might have wanted to have some resentments build up. These Gentiles coming into our promised land, we fought and died for it. But what's the law? Well, they're living among you. They get the full benefit of the law. Brethren, where I really learned this was in 1996. Was the first time that I really saw it. In 1996, that we'd been, you know, good friends with Jim Putterbaugh for 20 some odd years, and so I went over to Israel, went over to the Philippines on three different islands and preached with Jim for 5 weeks. And so we held three preacher training seminars on three different islands in 1996. I took Don and the kids for the first 10 days in Manila. So I'd grown up in Southern California close to the border, had made forays for surfing and whatnot into Mexico, and I wanted my family to know what real poverty actually was. So I took them over to the Philippines for that reason. And do you know, brethren, you cannot get medical care in the Philippines unless you got money. And you'll die, because it will not help you out if you haven't got the cash up front for an accident. So we've had several times through the years, we've had these panic-stricken appeals. I really need money. Somebody's taking a fall. You know, they broke their back. They're bleeding and all kinds of internal injuries. You know, it's desperate. We've got to have money because they can't get medical care. And so, you know, really different. And then I would see these orphans as what they looked to be. I don't know if they actually were. But I just saw so many very young children all alone, wandering out everywhere. One of them next to a highway was doing 50 miles an hour, and the kid, you know, was still pooping his pants. He was so young. I don't know how he hardly could walk. He was less than two. And so I just, how could he be out here? You know, they don't have lights. They don't have curbs. They don't have anything like you and I think. The kid was just at high risk. And immersed in that culture, I realized when you grow up in the United States of America, you are growing up in Disneyland. And you are so skewed and warped in all your thinking. If you haven't been to third world countries, if you haven't seen what it really is, and then you got all the high and mighty, you know, I'll tell that president how he ought to do, and I'll tell that Congress how they ought to do, and all the rest of that. You really need to be careful, brethren. You've got to know that Bible first, and then find some compassion second, and then recognize that we're living in Disneyland. The rest of the world, you know, hard scrabble existence and life's on the line for many of them every single moment of the day. So these laws are important, and they always have been. God didn't make these kind of laws to come and go, you know, whether or not it's before or after the cross, or you're a Jew or a Gentile. So I just think that's really important stuff, that verses 17 through 22. That's food for meditation. That's the kind of thing you want to ruminate on and bear in mind when you're formulating all your opinions about how, you know, immigration ought to be resolved. I don't have the solution for those immigration problems. I don't know anybody does, because nobody ever has been very effective at it. Certainly not in American history. We've been struggling with that one the whole way. Here are some principles I think we'd be wise, if we want God's favor, to apply maybe a little better than we currently do. Okay, chapter 25, verses 1 through 3 is your famous, I entitled mine, 40 Stripes Limit. But you want to make certain, next to these first three verses, that you write in the margin, 2 Corinthians 11:4. 2 Corinthians 11:4, which, don't turn, but I'll read for you. 2 Corinthians 11:4 says, if one comes and preaches another That's not right, is it? That's not it. What did I do wrong here? 2 Corinthians what? 11:24. Okay, well, that's just, it's a good thing you didn't turn, isn't it? You just knew it by heart. Okay, 24 I did. I left the 2 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. Now, how's that related to these first 3 verses in chapter 25? This says, if there's a dispute between men and they go to court, judge decides their case, they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, the wicked man deserves to be beaten. The judge shall then make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. He may beat him 40 times, but no more, lest he beat him with many more stripes than these, and your brother be degraded in your eyes. That's another one we're going to think about here for a couple of minutes. But why is a statement about 39 stripes or lashes got any bearing on this passage? You know this. Now, why is it? The Jews, ever, you know, making up new laws, in this case I think it's probably a really good one though, the Jews had decided that we don't want to lose count and accidentally get to 41. So they made their additional law that you could only beat a man 39 times. Lest if you had miscounted, you know, that would get you to 40. But if you beat him 40 and had miscount, it'd be 41. You'd be breaking the law. So they made it a habit to do 39 to ensure they didn't accidentally break the law. It's a pretty good idea, actually. You know, 40 was the limit, but they reduced it to 39. But brethren, verse 3, you know, what must you never do?
Degrade
the person who's committed your worst crimes. Now, you can beat him, and beat him hard, and a lot. Right? 39 is a bunch. You can require restitution. There's a whole lot of laws about the restitution and how much, and on it goes, and you can become your slave if he can't pay up what he owes you. We've studied that at length in Leviticus. All true. But is he to ever be degraded in your eyes? No. No. Now, brethren, again, we look across this border with all the furor, you know, we endlessly have to listen to on the news these days. And if you ever allow your heart to get hardened, to view people, you know, as less than human or anything like that, guilty of the crimes though they may be, brethren, the worst sinner that ever lived, question, made in the image of God or not? Made in the image of God. Have a spirit that will go back to be judged by God? Indeed he will. Let God be the judge. Now, punishment, jurisprudence, there's a lot of it in the Old Testament. And I wish we were practicing a whole lot more of that today. But you don't allow yourself to get all so high and mighty. You know, here I am, and those immigrants, and those criminals, and those homeless, and all the rest of that. It's bad, I know. They made bad choices, or else they're, you know, insane, and they're drug addicts, or whatever it is. But when you start getting all haughty and conceited, you've got a problem too. Don't let yourself be defiled because of somebody else's problems. Yes?
I have family, direct family, who are immigrants from Nogales, Mexico. And I know directly the issue. And my mother-in-law became my very best friend. She knew how to speak English. She was raised in a convent. Her family said there was too many children, they couldn't keep her, and so she learned English, and then her son, Anthony, and she was Bonita, came here, and they got their citizenship. I was very proud of them, and that is my family.
Well, you know, absolutely. And again, it's been quite a few years ago now, but I held a meeting in Portales, New Mexico, was where I had a real shocking, you know, kind of, I had to rethink all my immigration policy, if you will. But one of the elders down there, a very wealthy man, he owned 20 square miles of New Mexico. Big rancher. By the way, I've been on a cattle drive. Actually, yeah. I got to ride me a horse on a real deal cattle drive. And boy, was that hard on me. Makes you sore. But, you know, in his living room, there was this wonderful picture, and I can't remember now, you know, but it was like it had 20 or 30 people in it. And it was an old black and white picture from years gone by, you know. And so I asked him about it, you know, who's this? And he said, that is my family. So I'm standing there looking at this picture and wondering if I should go ahead and just ask. Well, how come half of them are clearly Mexican and the other half aren't? You know, how are they your family? And so I went ahead and I ventured the guess. He said, my family generations back has been working this land, and we would none of us have anything if it wasn't for those Mexicans from across the border. And they're my family. We've always loved them like family. And so when I show you that picture, you're looking at my family. Now, whether or not they're legal or illegal or anything else, he gave me to understand in no uncertain terms that all the people in that picture for generations had benefited from the fact that they learned how to work together and get along together, and they were all making a fine living, and, you know, they were family. I don't know. Maybe they all had green cards, you know, and all the rest of that. I really don't know. But still, that's the spirit. We are to be human beings, all of us made in the image of God. And so people come and they draw their borders, you know, and borders come and go. And you find smart people in government and really bad ones too. And so a lot of those laws, just wrong as wrong can be, but they are the laws. And it's a welter, brethren. It's such a tangle, you know, trying to sort through it all. But you don't degrade other human beings. You don't deprive other human beings. You give honor where honor is due, and honor is always due, you know, to the human being. So these principles, I think, you know, studying the Old Testament, brethren, is just so colossally important. And we're pretty bad at it as a rule. There's long been this spirit, you know, we live under the new and not the old, so we really need, you know, this time in the new. God gave us an entire Bible, and that Bible is a good deal more Old Testament than it is new. And to the extent that you spend your time in the Old Testament, and, you know, if it's three quarters old and one quarter new, if you were to spend three quarters of your time in the Old Testament, it would benefit your understanding of the New Testament immensely. Just immensely. It changes all your thinking to the extent that you become very conversant in the Old Testament. You sure enough change your eschatology, as I've been teaching on the book of Revelation and these other passages that we looked at. Once you realize all those figures are in the Old Testament and they're not talking about the end of the world there and everybody knows it, well, why are we going to take the identical expression and make it the end of the world when we get into the new? Conversant with the Old Testament, no Jew would be tempted to make that mistake. We do, because we don't know the Old Testament, and we do that in a host of things. All right, I've wandered off stopping myself, knowing I've got an extra class here, so let's go to verse 4. You shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing. Find a similar thing in Exodus 23:19, if you want to make the note. Exodus 23:19. And again, I really did want to expand, because I see now I've got, an extra class or two, but I'd really like to have you write down 1 Corinthians 9:3-18 here. 1 Corinthians 9:3-18. And join me there. And I don't know, might even close out the class tonight, but we're going to be coming to 1 Corinthians now in another 3-4 weeks maybe. But come on and look at this. 1 Corinthians 9 now. And I will in the Corinthians class have to really pick up the pace and be shorting this material. So I'm kind of seizing on the opportunity here. But come to 1 Corinthians 9 now. And we're going to read these 3-18, verses 3-18. My defense to those who examine me is this. Brethren, I don't think there's ever been a preacher who didn't live his life under siege. Preachers are always being accused of not knowing how to preach first. If only the people who've never preached, you know, would teach the guy how to do it, you know, and take all their advice and he'd be a better preacher. But they're always under siege for a wide variety of crimes that don't exist. They're not guilty. But since Paul, they're always being charged with greed, with arrogance, with, you know, all kind, you know, power grabbing, all this kind of stuff. Paul spends a very great deal of time in 1 and 2 Corinthians, chapters worth, just defending his own decisions on how to be a preacher. Now look at 1 Corinthians 9, verses 3 through 18. My defense to those who examine me, and they're all Christians, is this. Do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife, even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas, which of course you know to be Peter? Or do only Barnabas and I not have a right to refrain from working? Who at any time serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the fruit of it? Who tends a flock and does not use the milk of the flock? I'm not speaking these things according to human judgment. Am I? Or does not the law also say these things? Now, once again, brethren, this idea that there was the law, it's left behind, and unless it's quoted in the New Testament, it doesn't apply to us, is just wrong, 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 wrong. I was, you know, I cut my teeth on that. I taught it for a lot of years, but it just isn't so. So I'm not speaking this according to human judgment. Doesn't the law also say this? Paul was constantly using the moral values of the Old Testament as the foundation for his Christian teaching. Verse 9, it's written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing. God's not concerned about oxen, is he? Or is he speaking altogether for our sake? Yes, for our sake it was written. For the Christian's sake that was written. For our sake that was written. Because the plowman ought to plow in hope. The thresher to thresh in hope of sharing the crops. It wasn't about the ox. It was about the principle which endures in the New Testament. 11. If we sowed spiritual things in you, which very few oxen have ever done, by the way, that if we sowed spiritual things in you, is it too much if we should reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, do we not more? Nevertheless, we did not use this right, but we endure all things that we may cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple, and those who attend regularly to the altar have their share with the altar? Brethren, that's all Levitical law. We studied this extensively in these recent months. 14. So also the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. But I've used none of these things. Am I? And I'm not writing these things, and it may be done so in my case. It'd be better for me to die than have any man make my boast. It's perfectly acceptable to boast when it's no brag, just fact. To boast, you know, make it an empty one. For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of. I'm under compulsion. Woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me. What then is my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel. Now, bear in mind, we're going to be studying 1 Corinthians and we'll never get to 2nd, but, you know, at least 1st. And this whole idea, you know, of being paid to preach is likewise also said of the elders. They are also to be paid for what they do. Now, it's hardly ever done. Well, you don't find it in Corinthians, in Paul's letters to Timothy. But, you know, that is the case. Okay, and so these principles are all derived. Which bell is that now? Because the clock's off so far, I don't know if it's the first or the second. It's the second bell? So, okay. All right, well, we'll stop right there, and that's a good place anyway, because next week we are not going to talk about a Levitical law.
nor are we going to talk about a Levirate law as if it was Levitical. We're going to talk about the Levirate or Levirate law, which is L-E-V-I-R-A-T-E, not I-T-E. Levirate or Levirate law. Be sure you read verses 5 through 10, because that's a real interesting law in the Old Testament.